50% reportó algún tipo de abuso verbal, de acuerdo con la queja enviada al Departamento de Seguridad Nacional. Uno de cada cuatro niños reportó algún tipo de abuso, desde agresión sexual hasta empujones, patadas y puñetazos. Las organizaciones de derechos civiles y defensoras de migrantes exigen reformas inmediatas por la crisis humanitaria causada por el creciente aumento de niños centroamericanos cruzando la frontera solos. Expertos mexicanos alertan sobre los peligros del fracking, una polémica técnica usada por corporaciones energéticas para extraer gas y petróleo del subsuelo, usando grandes cantidades de agua y numerosos químicos desconocidos. Los opositores destacan que los mantos acuíferos son contaminados y que la técnica provoca terremotos. En México, el partido gobernante impulsa el uso de esa técnica del fracking a lo largo y ancho del territorio. El diario mexicano La Jornada entrevistó a Francisco Cravioto, investigador de Funda y del Centro de Análisis e Investigación, así como Natalie Seguín, coordinadora de FANMEX. Ambos forman parte de la Alianza Mexicana contra el Fracking.
Estamos a punto de abrir una caja de Pandora, una auténtica caja de Pandora, con la explotación de los yacimientos de lutitas, y pues quienes van a sufrir las consecuencias son los habitantes de estados al norte y al oriente del país.
Y va a permitir que entre esta explotación, que va a ser un boom de mediano plazo, va a dejar devastado al país en términos hídricos y de contaminación.
La fractura hidráulica, conocida más comúnmente como fracking, es una tecnología que permite la exploración y explotación del gas de esquisto. Este gas es básicamente gas metano atrapado en unas rocas llamadas justamente de esquisto, que se encuentran a grandes profundidades.
Hay dos innovaciones que han hecho, que han permitido que prolifere esta práctica, que es, se hace una barrenación vertical hasta 3 kilómetros de profundidad, buscando uno de estos yacimientos, y una vez que se encuentra, ya existe la técnica para hacer una barrenación horizontal. Esta barrenación puede ir de un kilómetro a un kilómetro y medio. Y ahí es lo que permite la barrenación horizontal es que desde un solo punto de perforación vertical se logra hacer una explotación bastante extendida. Esa es la primera innovación. La segunda innovación es no solamente utilizar agua como líquido de fractura, sino que al agua misma agregarle dos elementos importantes. Uno es agentes apuntalantes, que son cerámicas o arenas, que van en mezcladas con el agua y permiten, por ejemplo, en el caso de la explotación en lutitas, al momento de fracturar la roca, la misma presión de la tierra cierra las aperturas. Y entonces estas arenas y cerámicas mantienen estorban pues que se cierre la apertura permitiendo la salida del hidrocarburo. Y el segundo elemento es un cóctel de aproximadamente 934 sustancias químicas, cada una de ellas con una función muy específica, sea como bactericidas, como agentes para evitar la oxidación del conducto, etcétera. Las industrias que se dedican a esta actividad no comparten el secreto sobre la mezcla de líquido fractura por razones de competitividad, o así lo justificaron ellos cuando fueron forzados a comparecer ante la Comisión de Energía de la Cámara de Representantes de Estados Unidos hace un par de años. Lo que se sabe sobre lo que está presente en el líquido de fractura se debe a muestras que han sido recogidas de los suelos y aguas próximos a los sitios donde se realiza la fractura hidráulica. Y no solo de esos sitios, también del agua que sale de la llave de diferentes casas habitación que se encuentran también en regiones cercanas. De las sustancias que ya se han identificado, pues bueno, muchas de ellas son cancerígenas, provocan enfermedades en la piel, enfermedades en el sistema respiratorio, enfermedades en el sistema digestivo, migrañas, por supuesto daños al sistema neurológico, entre otras afectaciones, algunas fatales, como es el mismo cáncer, pues. Y son afectaciones que ya han sido documentados en más de 2.000 casos a lo largo y ancho de la Unión Americana, en diferentes comunidades que habitan cerca de los sitios de fracking. El único elemento que falta para corroborar que hay una responsabilidad jurídica de parte de las empresas con respecto a los daños a la salud que ha tenido esta gente es que ellos revelen cuál es el contenido de su líquido de fractura para que pueda corroborarse si las altas concentraciones de todos estos químicos tóxicos están directamente relacionadas con la práctica. Hasta ahorita solamente en un juzgado en Texas se ha indemnizado una familia precisamente donde por daños a la salud, donde se pudo comprobar, o por lo menos a los ojos del juez de ese distrito, se pudo comprobar que había un vínculo entre la contaminación y los daños a la salud. La mezcla vamos más o menos en estas proporciones: 97% es agua, 2% es estos apuntalantes, agentes apuntalantes, y menos de 1% de sustancias químicas. Estamos hablando de 300.000 litros de sustancias químicas por una sola barrenación horizontal.
La exploración de este tipo de gas, evidentemente, no es solamente a través de un pozo, se hacen miles de pozos. Y cada uno de esos pozos necesita, para cada fractura, para cada inyección, digamos, de mezcla, entre 9 y 29 millones de litros de agua potable. Entonces, nada más hagamos el cálculo. Anunciaron en Coahuila 1,000 pozos. Bueno, estamos hablando de millones de litros de agua en regiones donde no se ha cumplido el derecho al acceso al agua potable para todos los habitantes. Porque es una tecnología que no permite tener una agua de mala calidad. ¿Por qué? Por la mezcla de químicos que se tiene que hacer en todo el proceso, requieren forzosamente de agua pura. Entonces, justamente uno de los problemas que está habiendo en Coahuila y en Nuevo León se está cuestionando, afortunadamente, de dónde van a sacar esta agua.
La revista Forbes destaca en un artículo reciente que mientras en Estados Unidos, Francia, Irlanda, Holanda y Australia, entre muchos países, se ha prohibido parcialmente el uso del fracking por preocupaciones medioambientales, el gobierno mexicano se prepara a autorizar su uso de manera generalizada. Ignorando las multitudinarias acciones de calle en todo el país en contra de la monarquía parlamentaria, el Congreso de España ratificó la abdicación del rey Juan Carlos. Ahora se espera que su hijo sea coronado como rey próximamente. Rafael Cuesta, del informativo Más Voces, reporta desde España.
Queda aprobado el proyecto de ley orgánica por la que se hace efectiva la abdicación de su majestad el rey don Juan Carlos I de Borbón y se remitirá inmediatamente al Senado.
Como se esperaba, el Congreso de los Diputados ha ratificado la abdicación del rey Juan Carlos por abrumadora mayoría, 299 votos a favor frente a 23 abstenciones y 19 votos en contra. A pesar de la gran diferencia y de que Mariano Rajoy decía que no se debatía monarquía o república, el debate ha sido justamente ese, intenso, con abandonos del hemiciclo, pancartas y hasta proclamas republicanas y vivas al rey en la votación. Sin duda ha llamado la atención el papel del Partido Socialista Obrero Español, que no permitió libertad de voto a sus diputados, y es que era difícil de sostener la incoherencia mantenida por su aún secretario general Alfredo Pérez Rubalcaba al decir que los socialistas son republicanos, pero no incompatibles con la monarquía, para acto después apoyar la abdicación del monarca y la sucesión de su hijo varón Felipe de Borbón. El portavoz de la izquierda plural, Cayo Lara, ha criticado que la abdicación del rey se gestara de una manera oscura y que la jefatura del Estado se herede como si fuera una propiedad privada. La izquierda plural defiende un referéndum para que los ciudadanos se pronuncien sobre el modelo de Estado.
Tres palabras para dejar una herencia. Para dejar en herencia nada más y nada menos que la jefatura del Estado. Un señor la va a heredar como si fuera una propiedad privada. Se dice en la propia exposición de motivos, entre comillas, mi hijo, Felipe, heredero de la corona, encarna la estabilidad que es seña de identidad de la institución monárquica. ¿Y el pueblo qué opina? ¿No dice la Constitución que la soberanía nacional reside en el pueblo español? Señorías, la abdicación se ha gestado de una forma oscura, una especie de maniobra palaciega entre algunos de los partidos dinásticos que ha dejado al Parlamento de convidado de piedra. Han situado a los ciudadanos como súcditos, con un bombardeo a la opinión pública de alabanzas al heredero, endulzando la maniobra para presentarla como una regeneración del sistema. La sucesión por la línea de consanguinidad no tiene nada que ver con la regeneración, tal vez todo lo contrario. Es sangre nueva para una dinastía decrépita. Nos traen a la Cámara la abdicación con la transición acabada. Se ha agotado un modelo que ustedes y los banqueros y grandes empresarios quieren perpetuar con la apariencia de cambiarlo todo para que nada cambie.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
Tune in at 7 p.m. for the Great Leap Forward.
And do tune in at 7 p.m. for the Great Leap Forward. That's on Wednesday, And that's with John Malkin. You are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. I'm Robert, and this is Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides, the June 12th edition. We're in 2014 these days. And stay with us, and you can hear John Colby give some thoughts on the 180-180 program, and me play a lot of old tapes that give a lot of thoughts on a lot of different subjects, mostly on homeless issues on the street.
The homeless, a problem for only one reason. That president raises the question, who owns the land? The homeless, our problem for only one reason. Our president raises the question, who owns the land? Who owns the
a musical introduction. Welcome to Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. Again, call-in number, in case you have an urge to call in, is 831-427-3772. Again, 831-427-3772. and welcome calls, particularly if you have any updates on the issues we're discussing or stuff maybe peripheral to the issues we're discussing. If there's any immediate community news that's important, please feel free to call in at any time, whether it's related to the subject matter I'm talking about or not. This is a community radio station where we try to, in our own way, serve the community rather than have the community served up for lunch, which is the usual given our current state of affairs. So, I will kind of begin the show by introducing you to my guest who has the sense not to want to stay for the whole show, and therefore we're going to kind of give him a chance to make his thoughts known at the beginning of the show. Say something into the mic, John.
This is John Colby.
Hey, we're working. So, John Colby, just what is your expertise, John, and why should anybody listen to you about anything?
Well, I'm a scientist, and as I became an advocate for disabled homeless people, I ended up having to do a lot of public records requests, which led me to basically do a kind of form of data oriented to journalism, because basically that you need information from the source about what beyond the official line, what the actual regulations are, what is going on, and records. You know, a journalist would tell you that you should have a record state of mind when you do an investigation.
What kind of issues have you been researching, and for how long?
Well, as far as homelessness, I think that my initial research began during the Peace Camp 2010 demonstration, that I was really interested in the citations that were given out, and I was just curious because I had already done a lot of public research of records for basically other kinds of advocacy for on other issues related to a Section 8 complex. And
explain to people what Section 8 is.
Section 8 is a program by the government. There's project-based Section 8, which is basically tied to a fixed housing project, which is a smaller program, I think, or maybe not the smaller program, but it's one of the programs. And the other section is what's called the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which is basically vouchers which are portable and are not tied to specific property, but which a landlord enters into an agreement with a housing authority, which is a local agency kind of subcontracted out to by HUD to manage the program.
How many people does this impact in terms of how many people have get housing through this program?
You know, I can't really speak to that. I think it's probably at least 10 million people.
And what are the requirements in order to get into the Section 8 program?
In the Section 8 program, there's income requirements. There's, depending on the, for project-based, they can be project-based, which are the requirements are that you're disabled or you're elderly. And there are other projects that are have those requirements and that you have basically your income level falls beyond a certain threshold, which qualifies you for the program. And this and the voucher program is somewhat similar, but see, HUD has all these different programs, and they're talking about unifying them, so there's some consistency because their manuals on these things are thousands of pages long. They're used.
Generally, how poor do you have to be to get a Section 8 voucher?
Well,
or to get into one of their programs?
It's
a rough guess.
I think you could probably. The thing is that it depends on the area that you live in. It's usually tied to, if I understand it correctly, to a certain percentage. They have according to the income level of the area, geographic area that you live in,
mm-hmm.
It would be tied to the income, the average median, the percentage of the income level for that.
What
for
about
that area.
Santa Cruz? Any estimates there?
Well, you know, $19,000 would be considered just above very low income. So a lot of people on Section 8 have much lower incomes than that. You're talking about people who have SSI or are on Social Security, and their incomes might be their incomes might be they might be $800 a month, or there are even, you know, single mothers on families who are on welfare, and their income might be $300 a month, and they might have a family. And actually, the program goes as low as the lowest rent that you would have to pay. I think it was just recently increased. It used to be about $20. Say you had basically zero income, but it was increased to, I think last year the report, to about $50.
So how many people does this impact in Santa Cruz County, would you estimate?
Well, just to give you an idea of the Housing Choice Voucher Program, is that the waiting list, when I queried Ken Cole, who's the executive director of the Housing Authority of the County of Santa Cruz, is that the waiting list of households, not individuals, but households, is about 15,150 households. That was about maybe 8 months ago that I got that information. So,
and how many people actually have gotten vouchers that you know of that are currently using?
I don't know how many vouchers they give out per month. That wasn't something that I queried about. But basically, the average waiting time is, I think he said at this point, it's about, it's either 5 or 8 years. And often the thing about these vouchers, the housing choice vouchers that aren't tied to a project, is that you have to find a landlord who will, they give you 60 days to find a landlord who will accept the voucher. And this is a problem all over the country, is that places that are being gentrified, the landlords have no incentive to take a Section 8 voucher, because what the level that the housing authority will subsidize the landlord for, the market rate, is so much higher than that the housing authority will subsidize it for them, that why, you know, take this voucher, because they're going to lose money. They can rent it in the private market and they're going to make so much more money. So in places like Santa Cruz, it's almost impossible to find a landlord who will take a Section 8 voucher, that a lot of people are ending up in Watsonville or in Scotts Valley, or in, you know, basically fringe areas of the county, because in Santa Cruz itself, it's almost impossible to find a landlord who will accept a Section 8 voucher. And there's a time limit on how...
60 days, you're saying?
60 days. You can get extensions, or they're supposed to allow you to get extensions if you have disabilities or if there are mitigating circumstances, but it's a lot of people basically... from my understanding, don't find landlords in time and they lose their vouchers.
So, originally when we talked about your coming on the show today, and it was kind of a quick decision, so you kind of dragged you off the street here.
Right.
Sat you down in front of a mic, but, you know, you've had a strong, a somewhat skeptical, to be gentle, interest
right.
in the 180-180 program. Can you explain what they describe the 180-180 program as being? We've had other people talk about it. What exactly is this 180-180 program?
Well, the 180-180 program is based loosely on housing programs that were developed around the country in different areas, where they found that basically it's called supportive housing. And the idea is that the previous model was basically transitioning homeless people slowly into housing from shelters into transitional housing along the spectrum into permanent housing, of which there was very little to house them. And so, you know, a small minority were housed through this process in any case. But then in some cities, they found through innovative programs, I would call them innovative, was that just basically by housing people.
Housing first?
Housing first. Basically, that's supportive housing and housing first are the same idea, is that basically the best way to mitigate the cost of these people who basically...
Chronic
homeless people and medically vulnerable people who cost the system a lot of money, because they end up in the jails, they end up in the emergency rooms, they use all these social services.
So warehouse them fast, in other words.
Well, it might have, you know, turned out that way in some places, but the ideal is basically that the best way to deal with these people's issues of substance abuse,
give them housing.
Of substance abuse, is basically to give them housing, and it makes economic sense, because it saves money in the long run, but in the places where it was being, the places that I read about it, like San Francisco and Boston, I believe was another, where they used it on a large scale. They were converting a lot of single room occupancy hotels into supportive housing, not that in the practical sense that it was supportive as it was supposed to be or it was meant to be, but in any case, the model was of the supportive housing that basically get these people in the housing as quickly as possible, and once we get in the housing, then we can get them, plug them into the social service system, and we can mitigate the costs of what it would cost if they were on the streets and they were ending up being criminalized and they were ending up in the emergency rooms and they were basically a blight. And also, I think a little bit of it too was also to remove these people from the streets and make them invisible because people didn't like seeing them. And their hope was that, you know, if you have these people, you know, in housing, then they're not going to be on the streets where people don't want to see them.
Scare away the tourists, that sort of thing.
Exactly, something like that.
So, you know, I had an interview with a man called Peter Marin, who's a poet and a Santa Barbara activist and an advocate for the rights of people outside. And he made the point that there's been a great destruction of single-room occupancy housing throughout the country.
Not to mention
low-income housing generally. And in fact, when the economy turns up and gets better, that usually means it gets worse for homeless people because housing is destroyed by those who think that they've got better investment opportunities by doing that. So they remove the slum sections and make it available not for those who are living there, but for those who want to move in and gentrify the area. So you say that in Boston and San Francisco, and maybe now we should probably talk about Santa Cruz. You have this 180-180 program or whatever it's called, 100,000, I think it's called.
It's part of a larger campaign there. See, this is what's really unclear. They call themselves a community participant of a campaign by a nonprofit called...
Before you go into that, let me just finish my question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's good. I mean, it's interesting, but... in your understanding, has much more housing been created?
See, that's the whole point.
Or have they actually just essentially taken these SROs, spent some money and upgraded them, or maybe not even upgraded them, just put people in them?
See, that's the whole issue with the 180-180 project and the 100,000 homes campaign in particular, is specifically that they had this grand idea of supportive housing is the way to go, but they provided no funding for it. So they had this laudable goal in search of a funding mechanism, and so they were looking around for all these ways to do it from my reading of the website of the nonprofit which runs the 100,000 Homes campaign. And at some point, through looking at regulations, they found that housing authorities there's this little loophole that they can basically set aside. Well, they don't call it setting aside, but you might as well call it that. But they can set aside a certain portion of their Section 8 vouchers from the Housing Choice Voucher Program for a group which deserves to have a preference. So it's called a local preference. And so and the regulation for it, when you look at it, it's very vague, and it's only about two or three paragraphs long. So they started looking into this, and then there's all this, if you look at the communications, there's communications between people at HUD, and then they're going, well, you know, how can we do this without, you know, basically being accused of discriminating against people, and also how can we do this without being accused of setting aside vouchers, because they didn't want to be accused that they were setting aside, that they were, or maybe the word diverting, but anyways, they changed the wording to either a set aside instead of a diverting vouchers for some reason. I don't know why that was an issue for them, but in any case, the thing is that you have this program, this Housing Choice Voucher Program, where people wait up in some cities up to 10 years or more for a voucher, and it's constantly being cut by Congress. The funds for it are being cut, and then you have people on it who are the most vulnerable people in society. You have single mothers with families. You have very poor people. You have disabled people who aren't homeless but are that are on the brink of homelessness, if you know they don't find an affordable place to live. You have very elderly people who are living on a fixed income because Social Security doesn't provide them enough income to live in private housing. So you have people who are basically on the brink of homelessness if they don't find a place to live, and they're waiting 10 years for a voucher. So you have these other disenfranchised groups, and then when they have this local preference program, if you want to call it diversion or setting aside whatever, you're basically taking vouchers away from other disenfranchised people for a preferred group of disenfranchised people.
And the preferred group is those of the 180 program deems worthy? What are their criteria, do you know?
Well, they have this thing that this nonprofit called Community Solutions came up with, called a vulnerability index, and I've actually seen a copy of it, and I haven't looked at it recently and really studied it really closely, but it has a list of criteria, basically risk factors, about maybe 10 or 12, and it has, like, say, end-stage renal, kidney failure.
A series of serious ailments.
It has a whole bunch. It has about 10 of them, and it has one like mental illness with substance abuse. There are others, and if I had the document, I could read them off. But you know, at some point, if you'd like, I could provide you with it. But in any case, so. It's kind of arbitrary in a sense, because think of it. Here's, for example, a woman who I communicated with, whose son lives in Santa Cruz County. He's been diagnosed with serious schizophrenia, and he's living in the woods, and he's not in very good shape. And
have you spoken to him?
No, I haven't spoken to him. I've spoken to the mother. And she's devoted to basically getting this guy housing, and she's devoted her life to getting him out of homelessness, which is really laudable. I mean, she's kept working after retirement.
Is that what he wants?
I haven't spoken to him, so I can't speak from first-hand knowledge. I think he wants to be housed, but
and
a lot of things. He's got schizophrenia, but he's a very intelligent person. But in any case, he's got serious case of schizophrenia. He's been kicked out of all these restaurants and cafes and places.
Because for doing what?
For being disagreeable, I guess, or, you know, basically, he has issues.
Going off.
Whatever you want to say, going off, basically. But, you know, for things that people with schizophrenia do.
And this is an example of, you're using this as an instance of something you're going to...
Yeah, this is an instance of someone who, he lives in the woods, he eats a very sparse diet because I don't know if it's part of his mental illness or whatever, but he has a really strict diet, a regimen of what he'll eat, and he's got a lot of restrictions, which isn't unusual with an illness.
And so what does this show? What's your point?
Well, the point is that this guy is someone who really needs housing. He really needs housing. I mean, mm-hmm. but under their criterion, because if you look at... Under their criterion, he'd have to be a substance abuser. Basically, they add up the criteria of how many elements you match to get a vulnerability index of how many points.
Mm-hmm. And so, this trumps the current list in terms of priorities. In other words, if a person has been on the list for 10 years and they're about to get housing, they can be put back on the list because these new preferences come
not
up?
Exactly. What basically is, they set aside a certain number of vouchers, which has a limit, I believe, of 20% of the available vouchers. For the Housing Authority of Santa Cruz. I've seen the memorandum of understanding between the Housing Authority of the County of Santa Cruz and the Homeless Persons Health Project, which is an agency of the County of Santa Cruz. And they have a limit of so many that they're going to set aside. And another classification for basically the vulnerability would be if you're elderly. But so this guy is young. But he's got schizophrenia, but he's not a substance abuser, but he's living in the woods, and he's constant.
Would he have normally gotten a voucher in the absence of the 180-180 program?
See, that's no, he wouldn't be given a preference because I specifically queried Ken Cole, the executive director.
That's a preference for as part of the 180-180 program.
Well, I'm saying just in terms of the Housing Authority in general is that for someone who's disabled, no matter how severe their disability, if it doesn't fit into the – if they don't aren't homeless and they don't fit
so
in –
So this is a standard that doesn't just address that the 180-180 people use. It's a standard that the Santa Cruz Housing Authority, which deals with homeless vouchers, uses. Is
well,
that right?
Now tell them what the 180 program said about it.
No. It's basically it's administered by the 180-180. Well, it's not even clear what exactly the 180-180 project is because there's no one will produce the records telling me what the organizational structure of it is. But in any case, HPHP, the Homeless Persons Health Project, is the one that does the assessments that you go to basically when you want to become eligible with the 180-180 project. You go there. And theoretically, they assess you and they give you this vulnerability. They do a survey and they do this vulnerability
index. I understand. So the 180-180 is how many vouchers are generally available per month? I mean, what percentage are taken up by the 180-180 program per month of available vouchers?
From the maximum that they can take up, according to the memorandum,
it's 20%.
Is 20%.
So does that suggest that then the overwhelming majority of vouchers are distributed outside of the 180-180 program?
The other 80% theoretically would be distributed, would basically go to the people who are waiting already on the waiting list.
Regardless of the criteria?
Regardless of the criteria, yes.
So we're going to take a brief musical break, and we'll be right back. And Pat Colby may have something to say about this or not. We may have to lock her in the bathroom. That's another possibility.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
We're back. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Call in number is 427-3772. And we have two guests in the studio, John and Pat Colby. You've heard almost entirely from John, perhaps the occasional murmur of concern from Pat off to the side. She was making some comments, too, as we go on. But I want to, again, I'm trying to get back to this idea of looking at the vouchers available in this county. As I understand it, what you've told me, these vouchers are they the primary way in which people can find housing who are low income in Santa Cruz, in the county?
I would say that there's probably more people on the voucher system than there are projects necessarily.
Are there other means to get housing that are significant other than this voucher program?
For the homeless or for the non-homeless?
Both.
For the homeless, they're basically, from what I've seen, I don't think that you will ever find a homeless person ending up in an affordable housing project. So
My point is, to what extent is this program? You can answer this if you want to, Pat. To what extent is this voucher program a main means of people getting low-income housing?
It is the almost only source. The one thing exception I've heard of so far in exploring all this is the El Centro has a rate, and then it has a rate for people that were homeless, and that's like $200 to $300.
Is that mandated by some kind of government contract?
I'm not sure. Charles could answer that.
By the way, we're talking with Pat Colby. What are your credentials, Pat? Now we've heard John's credentials and his background. What about you? Why should people pay any attention to what you say?
Well, I've been kind of like right in the ditches, on the street, talking to people. I volunteer with the Circle Church Sunrise Cafe, which is on any day of the week with a tea in it from 4 a.m. to 9 a.m. where we feed people. We give them a place that they can sleep.
And where is the Circle Church?
The Circle Church is in Garfield on the west side of Santa Cruz.
In Garfield?
Garfield Park. So it's very welcoming. We try to...
Woodrow and California streets?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been hanging out with Robert Norris. I'm an official Huffster now, and I've been cop watching for different people that sell on the street and just kind of asking a lot of questions, even talking with some people at the Homeless Service Center that were willing to talk to me, and then also talking to a lot of people on Facebook. Because I want to see it from the homeless point of view.
Okay. So, again, the question for either of you is... So as I understand it, the main access to low-income housing is through the voucher program. And most of the voucher program is outside the 180-180 program. Is that correct?
Yes.
And if that's the case, is it also true that there's sort of a first-come, first-serve, longest on the waiting list gets served first process?
No.
Generally?
No.
Well, there is... For the people who are not homeless and chronically who don't fall within the 180-180 program.
So for 80% of the vouchers, there is a priority
right, basically,
list, which is
and
based
that's
on
why,
the time on the waiting list.
And that's why you have people who are waiting, 8 years, 9 years, whatever.
There was a scandal. I'm just going off the cuff here because I read about it, and I know that this local housing authority was caught where they were giving preference to Latino people on the waiting list over white people. So
this is Ken Cole's Housing Authority?
Yes.
So they're under investigation.
They were an investigation by the Office of Inspector General
Where can people find this allegation?
Actually, it was in the Sentinel. Someone sent a letter to the
Don't
Sentinel.
Don't say that word. We never say that word.
Senile.
Whatever, but...
Sent anal.
The local
like
rag... Basically,
did you do any independent research, or was the Sentinel accurate in this account?
Well, actually, that's interesting because I got an audit of them by the local...
An audit of who?
The Housing Authority.
In order to determine if there was preferential treatment to...
No, this was prior to this. They were audited by the by HUD's Fair Housing and Equal Opportunities Office in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
and I guess it was a random audit or something.
Does anything to do with the issue of the Latino discrimination?
Yes, it does, because what they found is they noted, and they didn't make any extrapolation of it, was that most of the employees of the Housing Authority of the County of Santa Cruz are Latino, and they noticed that most of the people who were getting vouchers, who were getting housed with these Section 8 vouchers, also happened to be Latino. And they made that as a note, but they didn't extrapolate it.
Well, the other question would be, what percentage of the population that is low income and available, or who would have signed up for the list, are Latino? Did you do any research on that?
I don't know, but I mean, in light of this allegation of this person who sent the letter to the to HUD, and also to...
What is the allegation?
Basically that these Latino employees...
We don't want these damn immigrants in our community sort of
that
thing.
That basically there was a form of, if you want to call it, reverse discrimination.
Exactly.
Well, nice. Allegations are a dime a dozen. I hear them from
Pat, they said that they,
from Pat Kittle all the time at
right,
the City Council.
Right, but these were... They said that basically they had witnessed people talking about it. I don't know. Well, I mean, you can go to the article and
read it. We need some stronger information about
it.
Right.
And this is a serious charge, and it certainly is one that I would, you know, if it's true, it should certainly be
known. We'll have to look into it.
However, to make it without any documentation concerns me, because I think it's...
Right, yeah. And I'm not making the allegation. I'm just telling you...
I'm simply trying to be politically correct here. I think if people are being, you know, getting preferential treatment beyond their status simply because of their race, although there's some who would say, you know, that a lot is owed to people who are, you know, minorities because of how they've been treated in the past, and I'm sympathetic to that, too. But still, it should be openly agreed to and understood and not be something that is... So if... I'm not sure what the story is. So let's get beyond that, shall we?
Because I just want to make one last comment on it.
Go ahead, Beth.
On the application for the Section 8 wait list, it does ask if you're Latino or non-Latino.
Well, that's required as for
does it ask if you're black? Does it ask if you're Native American?
Yes, it does. It asks. And it asks
so,
if you're disabled.
You know, that's a standard census thing.
Well, I actually was hoping to move up faster on the waiting list, so I marked Latino.
You better not... Well, you may
by accident.
Hopefully you are Latino. Otherwise, you have engaged in perjury, and you're admitting it on the air.
I'm a mutt, you know.
I see. Okay. All right. So, again, getting back to the point, you've had some concerns about the 180-180 program,
right.
John.
Because basically the reason I...
But before you tell me those concerns, I know I've been putting you off for 35 minutes here.
Right.
Trying to give background, sometimes perhaps too much background.
Right.
I'm trying to understand, first of all, the significance of this and whether there's a distinction. You were saying a few minutes ago that apparently a preferential treatment in the housing authority goes beyond independent of 180-180 program, involves a series of these other criteria, but or is that only for the 180-180?
No, this is just for the 180-180 program.
So 80%, is it fair to say, is your understanding, do you have any evidence that it is not true that 80% of the... You know, the stuff of the homeless people or people getting housing who are not on the 180-180 program are, in fact, getting it as their vouchers turn up chronologically.
That, theoretically, is the
theoretically,
how it works.
Or do you have some indication that's
Well,
really
that's how the program works. Basically, you get on a list.
Have you heard people complaining that that's not true? Has there been an audit one way or the other?
Well, you know, that's all conjecture, like you said.
So you haven't heard anything about that?
I've heard a lot of people saying that they've been waiting over 10 years.
Yeah. Have you heard them say that people got on who are not 180-180, but who were otherwise simply slipped ahead of them? That's my question.
I'm hearing people that are not 180-180 complaining that they've been on the list for 11 years, 12 years.
But again, you're not. My point is, has somebody who is not 180-180 and that 20% that's getting preferential criteria here, and we'll go into that in a moment, have they gotten on ahead of others on the program, or have you not heard
any
report?
Yes, this is actually the case, is that, and the housing authority will deny it, is that the CCIL, which is Central Coast for Independent Living, when I went to them for another issue...
That's a disability group, yeah.
Right, it basically serves people with disabilities, mm-hmm. And they said, why aren't you on the short list for disabled people for your housing choice voucher? And I go, there's more than one list? And they go, yeah, let me call up the housing authority and get you on the list. Because I had been waiting for, you know, like, I don't know, 5 years at that point or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly I got put on this supposed short list.
That doesn't
and
exist.
It, that doesn't exist officially. And then within about, I would so, say,
Go ahead.
And then within about 8 months, suddenly I came up with it for an application to take a voucher when I had already was in an affordable housing project.
Now, would that have normally happened, do you think, if you had not gotten on this so-called shortlist?
No.
And how do you know that?
Well, I had waited a long time, but I hadn't waited basically how long other people were on the list. Other people were waiting. At that time, the average wait time was about 10 years. The list was basically frozen. It wasn't moving at all.
So you're saying that 10 years in addition would have been your situation?
Well, actually, I think that it was basically, at that point, the story was that the list was closed and that it was basically frozen, that there was no movement because there were no new vouchers becoming available.
Let me just add that we also would call in and or write to get where our placement, we did it quite a few times, where our placement on the list was, and they send you a letter that says, people that have been on the list at this certain date are now being served.
Right, and we weren't really up for...
We weren't moving.
We weren't moving, and then suddenly...
What was the apparent lag that you would have had to wait had you not gotten on this short list?
It was like another 5 years.
It was a long time.
And then suddenly, within eight months...
I asked Ken Cole, because if you call the housing authority, you talk to people, and you ask them, well, can you put me on the disabled preference list? They say there is none. But that's not what CCIL said, and they actually talked to someone from the housing authority, and they said, you know, basically this guy's disabled, blah, 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 put him on the list. But in any case, I asked Ken Cole, when I asked him about the 180-180 project, I said, well, are disabled people who aren't homeless, are they given a preference? And he said, no. And I also asked him how many disabled people who aren't homeless are basically on the waiting list. And he said, we don't have an accurate statistic because, and he made an assertion without any justification for this assertion, because there's no way of basically proving it. He said that people who are disabled are reluctant to check off the disabled box on the application. So he really didn't want to, it seemed like he really didn't want to admit that there's a lot of people who are disabled but who aren't homeless, who aren't be given any preference at all, and also he's denying the existence of this so-called short list for disabled
people. It seems to me that this would be a public record.
Well,
only if they fill it.
In other words, the number of people who are disabled that they, you know, that mark the words disabled on the list, it would seem to me that would be a public record as to how many there are. Not their names necessarily, of course.
Right, yeah, you can make a public records request for all the applications and redact any private information.
Or just get a matrix, summary of what everything is.
I don't even know that they keep a matrix summary, but you could try to do that, yes.
But your concern is not so much about the 80%, although you're mentioning apparently a concern you have that there is a preference for disabled people an invisible or buried or hidden short list.
Some people tend to...
But that's not the 180-180 program. That's just generally for all vouchers. But you have a particular concern about the 180-180 program?
Right, because first of all...
Which is a much smaller part of the whole program.
Right, first of all, it's pitting one disenfranchised group, which are theoretically, chronically medically vulnerable disabled homeless people against other people who are disabled, other people, single mothers with children,
vulnerable.
People who are very vulnerable in their disenfranchised groups. So it's pitting them against each other. But also is the fact that if you look at the second thing is if you look at this vulnerability index, it's arbitrary. So here's a guy who's got serious schizophrenia. He's living in the woods. All his things are being stolen from him constantly. He can't hold on to things. He barely has money to exist. I mean, if anyone needs housing, I think this guy is pretty vulnerable. And then I had clients, and this is what basically set in motion all my research about
clients, in the sense that you're an advocate for those.
Right, an advocate, was that these were people in wheelchairs and walkers with chronic conditions like multiple sclerosis, fibromyalgia, all these conditions. I mean, people who were in their 40s who were in wheelchairs, which is, you know, somewhat elderly for a homeless person, who were in wheelchairs and walkers. And when this program started, they weren't going anywhere. And I wanted to get some accountability and find out, well, who's making this decision and why, you know, they're not moving. And so that's what led me to this research. So basically, the other element is in you have these arbitrary elements to describe basically how vulnerable you are. But in practice, it doesn't seem like even that is being followed. It seems like it's even more arbitrary than that. And I suspect, and this is my suspicion, is that there's some cherry picking going on, because if you look at it from the 180-180 people's point of view, they're trying to find Section 8 landlords who will take these homeless people. Now, a homeless person who's been homeless for a long time and is in really bad condition and, you know, has a mental illness and all this other stuff isn't really a prime candidate as a tenant.
I catch your drift. Would you say, though, that the 180-180 program not only involves this possible shifting around of preferences, but also involves sort of additional help for people in finding housing that they would not find, the other 80% aren't going to have?
Yes, it does.
And so insofar as it provides that, do you feel that the 180-180 provides a useful service to that 20%?
I don't know, because I don't know enough about what they provide. It seems, I mean, getting information about this, because they're in this gray zone of private, not private, of being an operation of a private nonprofit, but also there's these government agencies involved. I don't know how to get that information, because
it's like pulling teeth.
Well, if you talk to people in the 180-180 program who have, I mean, I'm wondering, most people don't get assistance in getting housing who are not on the 180-180 program, even if they have a voucher.
No, they don't get assistance. Basically,
whereas,
you get a deadline.
Whereas the 180-180 people have people kind of walking them through the program.
Right, the theoretical...
Two of our clients have.
Right, two of our clients have finally been...
Through 180-180?
No.
Well, they're...
They got vouchers first.
They got vouchers.
Right, but they had your help, but did...
Wrong.
Were they a part of the 180-180 program?
No.
Now they are part of the 180.
Now they are.
When did they become part of the 180?
After they got the vouchers.
Right.
Is that the normal?
No.
No, that isn't the normal
thing. So normally what happens is 180-180
secures the vouchers.
Finds people and then secures the vouchers.
Yes.
Why do you think it chose your two clients after they got their vouchers?
We don't know why. It doesn't make any sense, because they had already gone to the 180-180 program and applied. And we don't know why.
We think it had to do a lot with the king of public records here, exposing stuff.
I think they were trying to, should we say, sort of butter you up a bit.
Shut us up.
Right. Yeah. Or basically, perhaps they're being investigated by the government, because I, you know, asked
We've
the
reported.
Government to investigate them, and I filed complaints with different agencies. So
your
I don't
complaints,
know.
The substance of your complaints are is that there's a preferential treatment that denies the previously agreed upon chronology of when a person gets a voucher?
Well, that's only one part. The issues of the complaints that I brought before the government, with the Attorney General's Office of the State of New York, with the Attorney General's Office of the State of California, with the Department of Justice,
yeah,
is that there's that I believe that this charity, the
program 180-180,
Community Solutions. That's the national umbrella for all these community participants.
Yes.
That they're a fraudulent nonprofit.
In what way are they fraudulent?
It's kind of complicated.
In the sense they're not legally dotting their I's and crossing their T's, or are they in some way engaging in behavior that hurts the people they're supposed to serve?
They're not correctly legally.
So I'm interested, though,
they're
in the
calling
actual.
Themselves
I'm interested in the actual on the ground deficits or disadvantages or ripoffs that are happening to poor people. If that's true, or is it simply that there's some technicality that they're not legal?
Well, they're not legal, but also the thing is, if you start looking at this organization, it looks like basically what they do. It's a lot of hype. It's a lot of hype. It's like it's really.
Well, as I understand it, and I've never been a fan of the 180-180 program.
Right.
But they have, you know, the one service they do provide is They are making a rather concerted effort to get 180 people into housing that are in some ways vulnerable one way or another. And concern about this is they may be displacing others that should be coming up for their vouchers, but they are providing and helping the 180 people that they're putting into housing. Do you have any issue with either that, Pat?
Well, there was that issue that came up that was brought up to our attention at the Huff meeting. It's still, I probably don't want to say it on the radio, but some of the people generally were
the issue. You said the issue that was brought up is that this, they're going into housing that some people regard as in unsafe areas, or that they're mixing people who are alcoholic and drug using with those who are not. But I guess
there's a lot of criminal activity and violence.
The word criminal, again, like the word legal, does not impress me anyway, because the issue for me is, are people being hurt? I don't want these little, you know, we have a lot of stuff about people camping outside are criminals.
Right, yeah.
I don't give a shit about that. And I really don't care if they're dealing drugs either, frankly. I don't care about that. Pharmaceuticals are making a hell of a lot more money, and they're doing a hell of a lot more damage. As far as I'm concerned, that's crap, and that's a bogus approach. So my question to you is, what specific injuries are people suffering through this program, or alternately, is there a balance? Are they suffering some injuries? Are they suffering some advantages? What's your analysis?
What I was told, and I still have to find out where it's all coming from, but some people were shot and killed that had been placed in places by 180, and some people were stabbed to death.
You said people, we talked about this at the Huff meeting yesterday, we got one case of somebody somewhere, and you know, these
kinds of... I'm going to track down the names.
So
that's why I'm saying...
This is the subject of future research, okay?
The issue I have right now is, again, I ask you the question, I'm a little impatient because I want to know, forgive me for being impatient, but that's kind of how I am.
That's you.
And that is, you know... Again, I ask you. You know, you. It's all very nice to whip out the terrorist notions that are so redolent in our society and used to such great effect by people in power. And I don't like when people who are not in power use them either. You know. So my question is, weighing the advantages and the disadvantages, can you give me an assessment of both of this 180 program?
Well,
what are the advantages? What are the disadvantages?
The first issue is that They put all this effort and all their eggs in this basket, and all the talk about homelessness now is focused on the 180-180 project, and you're talking about the goal of 180 people when in just the city of Santa Cruz there's 1,500-plus people who go unsheltered on any given night. So it's a drop in the bucket, which is one thing. The second thing is that the vulnerability in the criteria which is used in theory, if they're even really using this criteria, is it's arbitrary
and inconsistent.
So it's arbitrary and inconsistent. So it's basically, it's kind of like saying, taking people's disabilities and making apples and oranges and saying, well, this disability is, we say this disability is worse than this, and you know, is it merits you more as being vulnerable than this other disability. And it's arbitrary. Like, for example,
are more people going into housing than would have been the case if this 180-180 program hadn't been put into effect?
Not really.
Well,
I'm hearing things where some of the people have used the 180, but they didn't like the housing, so they pulled themselves out.
Well, this is also an issue that is a long-term issue, is that this comes along with the funding mechanism of using the Section 8 program as the funding mechanism for the 180-180 program. It's not the right funding mechanism for housing homeless people, because basically you're taking a program which is you're taking them for landlords who have a certain criteria of people that they, you know, that they want to have. They don't really want problem tenants. And homeless people, the whole idea of supportive housing is that you have all these support for these people because they have a lot of problems. Keeping them supportive throughout the process, it costs a lot of money and it's a lot of effort because they don't adjust quickly to be coming housing. They have issues after being on the street for a long time.
So I have some issues with what you're saying.
So what I'm saying, if you let me finish, what I predicted is going to happen is that they're putting all their eggs into the basket of just getting these people into housing. But once they're housed, at some point, my expectation is that these people are end up going to being evicted from their Section 8 housing when these landlords find them to be problematic. For example, they don't get the rent on time, or they disturb other tenants, or, you know, they hoard, or other issues come up that just basically come up with part of being a homeless person who's put into housing. So that, because the Section 8 housing...
I got your drift.
Right, okay.
I wanted to make a comment.
I know, but I'm going to make a comment first.
Of course.
And that is... you know, I heard this thing about, you know, homeless people are a particular problem in getting into housing and so forth. And I guess I don't like that kind of analysis. I don't think it's true. I think most homeless people are no worse than any other ordinary tenants. It is true, however, that if you look particularly for vulnerable people on the streets that you want to eliminate because they've had problems in the past with alcoholism or, you know, they become sort of entrenched in what they're doing. Having seen the way the society operates around them, and they're trying to be individuals themselves their own way, given the very limited resources they have. I can see your point that there would be a... your suggestion is the program is set to fail, and perhaps you're suggesting that this is a way... this will discourage other similar programs that might, in fact, succeed.
No,
if
I'm not saying it's set to fail. I'm just saying that basically it's all... fixated on getting people into housing, but the whole concept of supportive housing is that there's a network of support that keeps supporting people once they're in the housing. So
what's the network of support? I mean,
well, there's social, basically in these SROs in San Francisco and Boston, when they house these people, there's support, there's social service coordinators and all these social
services.
You
think these are good things?
I think
if people want to reach out for them,
when they do it right, it is good. It has.
Have you had experience with people who have actually found these to be good things?
No. I mean,
I'm very skeptical of it, but my skepticism is not based on a lot of experience. Pat has something to say, too.
Well, what I wanted to say is I agree with your comment, Robert. It's not that because they were homeless that they have a hard time adjusting. It's the reasons that caused them to be homeless, drug addictions, mental illness.
I disagree with that as well. I don't think that's what causes people
to be homeless.
But what
I'm saying...
that's not what causes people
to
be
homeless. No, I'm not saying it
caused.
Then
don't say it if that's
what
you mean.
You know? What I'm trying to say is it has nothing to do with homeless or house issues. The issues of why they eventually get evicted is because either their mental illness interferes with other tenants or their alcoholism or their... drug addiction.
I disagree with that as well.
Well, look at this, Robert.
I think it has to do with discriminatory treatment as well. You know, I think that, you know, there is a certain, you know, tenants and landlords have different interests, and some people can survive longer with their landlords, and some people have good relationships with their landlords. But these are two different disparate groups. Landlords are you know, essentially profiteering off of the tenants, and what I regard as, you know, unsavory kind of transaction.
Carpetbaggers.
Generally. So the fact of the matter is, in our society generally, people will have, you know, there's a rocky relationship, and you'll often, tenants will lose out because tenants don't have rights, particularly in Santa Cruz. So to say that, then to blame the tenants for this stuff.
I'm not.
I just heard Pat blaming.
I didn't blame them per se.
No, because of their alcoholism.
She's not blaming them. She's explaining basically.
Well, to suggest that it is their responsibility.
Okay, let me give you an example.
Wait, no, I don't want an example. I'm talking about the general criteria, which says that, you know, the reason that the problems arise in a landlord situation or a homeless situation is because of alcoholism, drug abuse, or mental illness. These are the...
I said
these are the charismatic, these are the token brands that are being put on people throughout Santa Cruz that don't have a hell of a lot to do with what the real situation is, which is mainly homelessness, lack of housing.
Right.
And so I don't think, I'm sorry, I'm really interrupting the narrative because I don't like this mythology that gets thrown into it and weaved into it. And I hear it even in your own.
So are you saying in essence that you don't agree with the concept of supportive housing?
I don't know if I agree with that or not. I do know that when I hear people being, when I hear a homeless advocate, as Pat describes yourself as being, saying that, oh, well, you know, if they get thrown out of the housing because of their problems with alcohol or their problems. In other words, it's all about apportioning
an
individual with problems that somehow define their status instead of the fact that there are other things that define it much, much more significantly. And I think that has to do with how the society is set up and how housing works.
Right.
You know,
well,
and,
I would like to see...
let's put that aside.
I'd like to see housing where people can get into rehab if that's what they choose to do. But, for example, when I got transferred to a different apartment, I had a paranoid schizophrenic person above me who had been homeless for many years, had a drug addiction problem and an alcohol problem. And because of the situation... She was
using the same kind of mythology.
I'm sorry, I'm trying.
If you're you want to talk about this person was screaming at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right, that's what
always,
she ended up.
That's what you should talk
that's
about.
That's what she
well,
ended
spare
up.
Spare me
she,
the fucking labels and
okay.
spare me
she's
the drug
about
abuse
the behaviors.
Problem.
I'm talking about the
no,
behaviors.
You're not. No, you're not. You're
well,
using
I'm
the labels. Fuck
okay.
the labels.
I'm just saying
the
there was behaviors no. going on of hoarding. There was behaviors of stalking of me. There was behaviors
stalking
where...
Stalking of other tenants, too.
Right, and leaving
okay, well,
dead rats.
Then behaviors have to be addressed.
Right,
right.
And that's what I'm trying to
okay.
say.
Maybe you're trying to be nice and say, well, I don't want to... You know, I'm trying to understand that this isn't a person
right.
who sets out in life
but,
to
but
leave
Robert,
dead rats
but,
around.
But look, if you take your view, then basically you're basically contrary to the whole idea of supportive housing, because the idea of supportive housing is these people need support. Is that they need support in housing. You can't just dump them into housing and they can do
they don't
just
know
as
how
well
to run
as
a house.
I think people initially need housing before
right.
they need any of this vast complex of support, so-called
right.
support. That's the point. Housing first. Doesn't mean support services first. It means housing
but the
first.
The concept that they're coming off of is supportive housing, which is what they're also promising... But they're not necessarily delivering or going to deliver because the funding mechanism doesn't allow
again,
that.
Again, as I said, I'm ambivalent toward. I'm not opposed to it. I'm ambivalent to it, but I do not like the idea that that's some sort of precondition and real description of people outside. I don't think
right.
it's
well,
no.
I,
it doesn't apply to everyone.
I'm not saying it does not. I'm just saying it does not
it
apply.
It can apply to people that are
apply,
even housed.
It does not apply to people who are in the homeless category at all. It applies to the population generally, some
exactly.
of whom are housed and some of whom are homeless. So when you talk about dealing with homelessness, you don't bring up those issues primarily unless you are part of this modern right-wing horseshit that is rolling over
I
Santa Cruz and elsewhere.
I disagree with you on this issue.
Okay, I do have one comment I did want to say.
But he's disagreeing with me. I'm sorry, you're going to have to wait.
No, hold on.
No.
My suggestion here is the kind of housing with the funds that they did get that they've used for the administrators to be paid is they should have built halfway type houses to transition housing first, people into housing.
All right, you know, I
that's
okay,
my
that,
idea.
I understand that. So we have a difference of opinion here. John, you wanted to say something?
The whole point of this supportive housing is that when you put these people into housing, who basically, if you don't, I know you don't agree with this, but the what they
I, mean, I know what a supportive housing is. There's no need to redefine it.
Well,
I mean, I understand
what I'm saying
it is
that these people, when you've been on the street for a long time. You know, you're not used to all the things that a regular tenant
bills,
you learn to write
pain.
Checks again. You know, I'm sorry, I don't agree.
Okay, but in any case, but
I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I haven't got a lot of empirical.
But in
I've
any case,
seen
the supportive
that
evi-
in
the,
Section
the thing
8.
With supportive housing is that mm-hmm. you don't just get these people into housing and get them into an SRO hotel, but in the places where it actually works is you support these people with. And this is where the whole supposed savings and money comes. You support these people with social services, with medical services, so that you reduce
job training.
You reduce, visits to the hospital, visits to the jails, visits to the jail. You know,
and
sort
there's
of.
A whole point that often these things are related to all kinds of other considerations that have nothing to do with the intrinsic characteristics of these people. It is, yes, a budget-saving measure for a city that has decided to criminalize its homeless and not provide meaningful meaningful preventive medicine. Yes,
yeah,
that
and I'm
is
not
true.
Saying that's my but rationale it, for supportive housing.
It doesn't
housing.
Provide
that's
mental
not,
health
That's not
care.
My rationale for supportive
and my
housing.
My point is that if you have SROs for people to use, if you as you used to have them, people you might, you know, they would come and go from them. You know, if you want to go live in a flop house, they should be able to live in a flop house.
I agree.
If other people want it, they don't exist now. Now it is connected with supportive housing. You have to be supported in your housing in order to do it. And it costs a huge amount of more money, more. And it also is a way of stigmatizing the people who are essentially displaced urban residents. Mm. And I don't like
that.
So
I do agree with you. You made a point. Like these.
So, but I mean, the issue here.
Boarding houses are gone. I had a friend that traveled all across the United States as a journeyman printer. When he got fed up with a boss, he would close his slip.
He's not a journeyman printer. He's a person with a mental health problem. You know,
no.
Thank you so much.
I mean, no, he just liked to travel.
Yeah, well, no. I'm sorry. Maybe he has
so he stayed in these SROs and these.
No. There used to be an illness that they described slaves as.
No.
It's called draphomania, the pathological desire to be free of the slave.
He was a free agent.
Yeah, it's just, you know.
And
it's, so in other
world
words,
isn't
point,
made
and
for
I'm
that.
Making, I'm making a sarcastic point. But
I know that.
But let us get back. Let us get back to, again, the point why what you wanted to talk about in the studio, and that is your critique of the 180-180 program, which you've done, and I've asked you again to assess its advantages. I don't hear you saying there are any advantages, so I don't think you think there are any advantages.
Well, you know,
I mean, that's
I
okay.
can't even I get the information because the way they've this program is like. It's so nebulous and it's so in this gray area between public and private. I can't get records, to document this kinds of.
What
things.
About you, Pat? Have you found people in the 180-180 program who like it?
No, I've been
how
asking.
How many people have you talked to who are in the 180-180 program?
I've talked to a few. I've been begging.
How many?
About three. I've been begging the people that are running the 180 program. Hey, I really would love to see your success stories. Can you show me? Can I interview? Can I meet? Do you have some documents? Anything to show your success stories?
Well, what's a success story? Someone is in a housing?
Yeah, and you
well,
know.
They say they've gotten 180 people into housing, is what they say.
152 is what I heard.
I've heard it was 180 now, but I don't know what the real figures are.
Okay, so where are these people? Who
are you,
these people?
Are you
people?
Saying that they're lying? They don't have 152 people
I don't
in
know.
Housing?
I don't know.
She's just saying, why
from
don't you,
what
have,
I
why don't you
okay.
have success stories to you know?
Count.
Well, you're basing your sample on three people who didn't like the 180-180 program. I mean,
no, I'm not basing.
Well, then you didn't talk to anybody else, though, did you, Pat?
But I'm asking
did
for
you,
these.
Did you? No. You got to go talk to the people, not the... Not
and I'm
the,
trying to
not,
find
not,
them.
Not, well,
she's talking to people that she's meeting through her advocacy for homeless people.
But what I'm saying is I asked the program, can you please introduce me?
No, you don't have to
repeat
it.
What he's talking about is talking to the people that you're asking at the through
you have,
your
there
advocacy.
There are plenty of people who are homeless on the streets who you've talked to. And you say you haven't talked. You've only talked to three people in the 180-180 program.
Oh, okay. The people that I've met I've talked to about 20.
Anyway, I'm sharply skeptical of your,
but
of,
in
your,
any
of,
case,
your of your samples. But I want
to talk to about
but
20 people.
But I want to say, wait a minute. You talked to 20 people in the 180-180 program
that are familiar with it.
In the
180,
no.
Not in.
Okay,
not in.
Okay. Well, are you saying that all these people have been critical of it?
A lot of people have negative.
Are you saying that all these people have been critical of it?
Pretty much.
Okay. That's not my experience, although I haven't talked to a lot of people either way. I don't usually.
Can you find them? Where are they?
They call into the show sometimes.
Well, that's good, because I haven't been successful.
Well, it's. You'll just have to keep
working. But in any case, the whole point is that they're touting all this hoopla about all the efforts about the homeless now in Santa Cruz.
I know. You're repeating yourself now, John.
No, but I'm saying it's only 180 people.
I know. You're repeating yourself. You said that 15 minutes ago, and I agree with you. I often say the same thing. What I'm trying to do, though, is having covered that ground, you know, we have no new information. Perhaps somebody out there has some information.
Yeah, please call
427-3772 is the call-in number. So please give a call, and we can, although I, you know, haven't been getting a lot of calls lately, so don't get your
hopes up. Yeah, I'd love to hear from 180
people. I'm
going
to turn
now
to other issues, and if you get more information on this subject, I would like to hear it, for sure.
Okay.
And again, I've invited, I'll try once more to see if we can get Linda LeMaster to give a call in. She's an individual who has been working with, like, Smart Solutions. I get these programs mixed up, so I'm not entirely sure. But we'll see if we can reach her on the phone. It's always a challenge, particularly when they...
Want me to try my cell phone?
Interesting. I think we're actually getting through here. Let's see what's happening. So, again, the call-in number here is 427-3772. Hello, Linda. Are you there? Excuse me, folks. I'm having a little trouble getting a little frustrated with the phone here.
Kick it. That should make it work.
Okay. So we're trying again to give a ring to...
Hello?
Linda.
Yep.
You're being bushwhacked and you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
And are you the bushwhacker?
I am. I'm whacking you. I'm not going to say I'm whacking your bush because that would sound inappropriate.
So. Great. What?
In the studio with me are Pat and John Colby. You may remember them.
Hi. Yeah, I've met both of them.
Hi.
And we're talking about the 180-180 program. And I don't know, did you get my previous message? I called you about an hour ago.
Yeah, I hadn't had a chance to tune in, though, so I do feel ambushed.
Okay, well, you don't have to. I don't feel obliged
just
to.
No, what are you...
Sorry?
What is it you would like?
Well, I was asking Pat and John, who have a very critical view of the 180-180 program, to say the least, whether they were to assess its benefits and its drawbacks, what they would say. And they essentially found no benefits that I could hear from either of them. And the drawbacks that they asserted were, one, that it's illegal, which I didn't think was a particularly... I don't give a shit if something is legal or illegal if it serves people. Two, that it's discriminatory and arbitrary and has vague standards. Three, that it takes away vouchers from people who have been waiting for them. And four, that it gives a misimpression of addressing homelessness in Santa Cruz County, getting everyone worked up to deal with that, but actually it only deals with a small percentage of people. Does that fairly cover it, folks?
Yeah, it does.
So, Linda, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I think each one of those assertions makes good sense. Even though there's some I might have a different take on, I think those are valid observations. You know, I mean, it's a program that started itself by saying they're going to go out in the bushes and find the people that are most unserved. And while that might have been a noble response to what was happening to the money, the new homeless people didn't want to leave any money for the old homeless people. No, they were putting that in all the metropolitan daily papers. And this, at least, was an arm out for the people that have consistently been unserved or unreachable before. So that's a noble impulse, or you could say motive or purpose, but still kind of like just starting from where we are, irregardless of what's going on around us. And I think there's a lot of justification for questioning that kind of use of public and very limited economic resources. But I like the program because they are housing people. And yet I've talked out of this, let's say, almost a half a dozen people that have been housed. Actually, one was in the process of being housed. I get a mixed feedback from the clients. So pull out one of those many things you said in your summary of them, or maybe Pat or John would like to say something. I'll see if I can counter it or play devil's advocate, or if I just flat out actually disagree.
Okay, well, first of all, if you look at the vulnerability index that the 180-180 project uses and the 100,000 homes program uses in general throughout the nation, is that the elements for that you count up points for whether, you know, how vulnerable someone is, that they're kind of arbitrary, and that people who might be very vulnerable at risk of, you know, at very vulnerable and being at risk of serious harm, basically, if they don't fit into these arbitrary classifications for one reason or another, then, you know, they don't score very high on it. Like, for example, a single mother who's disabled, with a daughter who's disabled, but she, maybe they, there's, or another person who has incidents of physical and mental disabilities, but they don't have, they're not substance abusers, so they don't fit that criteria. So they're basically, they don't get a point for something like that. Or they're not elderly. They're, you know, they're a vulnerable person, but they're not elderly, so they don't fit the elderly criteria. I mean, if you look at all the 8 or so points. The other thing is that the funding mechanism, the Section 8 program, is the is totally inappropriate to supportive housing, because basically they're setting these people up to fail. They're not going to be people who are going to be sustainable with private landlords who generally take a larger Section 8 population. They're going to be problem tenants who, if they, even with, I don't think the support's going to be there throughout the process, because they're so rushing to get these people into housing. I don't think they're really thinking about, you know, about a more, even more costly long-term support. But once these people are in housing, and this even happens, you know, in supportive housing, so-called supportive housing, is that people fall through the cracks. They start becoming problem tenants, and then they get evicted. And, you know, this even happens in supportive housing, where a lot of homeless people get evicted out of supportive housing. What's going to happen for these people who are in Section 8 housing, which wasn't really designed as a program for this population?
Your thoughts, Linda?
I'll tackle that last little part of it. These vouchers that are being given to disabled people, and some of them through the 180-180 program, while everyone else on the housing authority list is frozen or closed or whatever they're calling it, that is a transfer of money to these people. But the housing that the people will get in the 180-180 program, one, will be through what they call a master lease. I'm sure you know what that means, John, but we can tell everyone.
No, actually,
listening.
I haven't heard that term, master lease.
Oh, okay. A master lease is the way these nonprofits around here are talking about. There's a middleman agent between the tenant and the landlord. Now, that might not be all there is to it, but essentially, a nonprofit agent will be held accountable for that tenant's deleterious behaviors rather than the tenant.
That's good.
And that person will make sure their rent gets paid on time rather than the tenant.
Do you think there's the funding for that, you know, that sort of level of support?
They claim that most of these people, like, I know Families in Transition has the funding. I can't say firsthand yes about some of the others that are in that position. But the program that HSC Director Monica Martinez is now going to be working for has had funding specifically for that from the state in the past. I don't know the particulars. I can't remember numbers, so it's hard to go beyond being a generalist. But I don't think that constitutes what I imagine you and I would configure as a support system or a case management system, or the phrase I've heard 180-180 people use, wraparound support. And I don't see anyone willing to define what the case management or wraparound support means. I mean, they hold up the federal definition, and that's just, you know, a list of minimum requirements. It doesn't define what kind of people are doing what things for this client or for all the clients or any little subset of them. It's kind of, if it's invisible, we can't help but wonder if it's all there.
So let me ask you, Linda, you say you've talked to about half a dozen people who've given you mixed reports on 180-180 who are actually clients or recipients?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, people that were in the process of or had been placed through that program.
What we've heard,
and all of them in this case would have, I think, I believe, would have gotten it to a housing authority voucher, and one of them also was a veteran.
They would have what? I'm sorry?
The the primary money for their housing, would it come to a housing authority kind of voucher, the Section 8 thing you were talking about?
So what's the significance of that? I don't understand why you mention it. What's the point?
I'm just saying this is what I know about these people that I'm able to reveal.
I think she's saying that they had vouchers already.
So you're saying they had vouchers already?
No, that one of them did. But what I'm saying is they get that amount of a financial commitment for however long they can keep the place. Of paying it through the Section 8 voucher program.
And this is this is a
federal money conduit.
This is above and beyond, let's say, the 80% of the people who aren't in the 180-180 program who are getting vouchers. Because I understand that this only covers 20% of the people getting vouchers.
I didn't know it was that high. That's kind of alarming.
Yeah, it is. It's 20%.
Well, that's what John tells me. I've got no idea.
The maximum set aside.
So if that's the case,
if you're talking about right now, the only people getting Housing Authority Section 8 / voucher subsidies are disabled people. If you don't already have one, you're on a waiting list that doesn't move unless you're disabled.
What I'm saying, no, that's not my, and that's interesting to know, that's not my question. My question is, of the 80% who have vouchers, only, you know, there's 100% who have vouchers. There's a group of people who have vouchers. 80% of them are not on the 180-180 program. Right? At least that's, or
okay.
More, maybe.
Got
I don't know.
Now.
If we assume that's the case, if we assume John is correct here. The issue is, are they having more trouble finding housing than the people on the 180-180 program, the other 20%?
If you're talking about personal effort, absolutely, yes. If you're talking about is it harder by yourself than with a crew, I'm not sure, because it's not easy just because you have, you know, like for me to get a therapist or a telephone agent to find me a place to live, would be like you getting your uncle or your sister to do it. It's extra help, but that doesn't mean it's easier. I don't know if that's
an answer. So if you, you said you had some positive feelings about the 180-180 program. Why is that? On what basis are you saying that?
Because I don't see any, this is strictly from my gut. And if you had called me and you wanted a program analysis, I'm afraid I'd probably fall right in the same sandbox with John. In a lot of ways. But from where I sit, it's the only program that gets out there in the bushes, so to speak. It's housing people that long ago gave up thinking they'd even get temporary housing. And if it's really reaching those people through that index that John was questioning, then it's very important, but it's not so important that it should be above transparency. It means it needs to be replicated.
Okay. Well, listen, we're going to talk about this for 20 minutes. We're going to talk about it for an hour and 20 minutes. Is there anything more you want to say about it?
Can you ask her about the negative experiences people have expressed to her?
Okay, I will do that. But, John wonders what negative things you've heard about the 180-180 program.
I guess one story in particular. The person has a housing navigator. Now, that person will help them get housed, but then won't be part of their support team. I don't know who will. Don't know the person's first name or anything. But this guy, while he lives way up in the outback in the mountains, he had some trouble getting moved in the date that he had been promised, and it frustrated his helpers as well as him. And he had a storage locker that he'd given an exit date to because he has belongings, like so many homeless people that have any income whatsoever. And while he didn't have access to them while he's living under the greenery, he's paying for them every month in case he ever gets housed. This is an old man, almost 90. And
so this is what, a schedule?
You know, like, there's no truck in the 180-180 program. There is no truck.
So this is a scheduling foul-up or something to that effect, or...?
It's a comedy of errors that
there is
not a volunteer capacity for the kind of real problems that people that are homeless over time are going to have.
What percentage?
They need a couple churches behind them or something.
Do we know what percentage of the 180-180 program actually serves homeless people as distinguished from, I don't know, disabled folks who have some other kind of housing?
No, you have to be homeless. That's that 8-point scoring thing, it seemed to me that this may have changed. I would like to see the current configuration, but when it was just a proposal, you had to be no medical care. You had to be homeless 3 years or more, things like that.
Okay, is that your understanding, John?
Right, but basically there is a distinction, and I asked Ken Cole, people who are disabled, who are not homeless, are not covered under the local preference program for the housing, for the 180-180 program.
So they don't get into the 180-180 program.
So they don't get into the 180-180
okay,
program.
It's about homeless folks. All right.
It's about chronic homeless folks.
Is there any general criticism, not just one particular case of somebody who, you know, couldn't get his storage stuff together? Huh? That's for you, Linda.
I just think that they need... There's a scuttlebutt that people are saying, oh, we'll help finish building your support services later. That'll come later. Let's just get you settled in. Here's the key. You know, here's your lease. We'll help you with this part. And what does later mean? I mean, how can that be half the program and they figure it out later?
That's my main concern, John.
Yes, it is.
So I thank you both for that. Anything else, Linda, you want to say before I move on?
Yeah, I think that because if this is true, if what I'm saying and what John's saying is true, because that program and the primary nonprofits that I think it's linked to or supported by, let's say, being vague, if they can't provide that, then why can't they open it up to a more public process and let all the people in this town that want to help somebody in on it and create real little teams that you can see and that we can appreciate?
I totally agree with you. Like, hey, does somebody have a truck? You know, bring a truck.
Yeah.
Hey, can some volunteers come and help move this stuff? It's like make it a community.
A community effort.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate all this, and I'm going to roll on. And if any of you have any updates on the 180-180 and or smart solutions or other nonsense of this kind, let me know, because we'll discuss it and, you know, see what's cooking. Linda, you have something you want to say?
You asked for an update. I was going to say, I heard Phil of 180-180 say they're going to sit down and reevaluate the program before the next launch. In other words, they're going to keep trying to help house people, but they have to figure things out, and it might look or feel a little different.
Have they housed 180 people this time already?
They've housed 5 or 7 more than that.
Do you know what the retention rate is?
I don't know, but I mean this whole program had 1 year to meet its goal, and that would have been July 1st, and it did. So we need to find out if the first few people, by the way, who were publicized, are still in their house.
Yeah. Pat has a final comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, as much as I'm putting down the 180-180 program, I've been working with a client who is going through the 180-180 now. And I have to say, Robin and Alexis and Chris at the Homeless Service Center, they've all been really caring and really helpful. So it's not the people that are in there doing it, volunteering or even getting paid. It's just kind of the
structural.
The structural thing. So I just did want to say that those people are really wonderful.
Yeah, and you're one of those people, Pat. You're one of the people.
Well, I know they thank me for helping them.
That helping to stick.
But they really do try.
Yeah. All righty. Well, we'll leave it there. And thanks, Linda. Thanks, Pat. Thanks, John. We're going to take a musical break, and we'll be right back. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org.
Oh, vida guantanamera. Guantanamera, guajira guantanamera.
And that was Guantanamera, again, from an album by, well, it's called Sowing the Seeds, the 10th anniversary. A lot of good music there. Let's turn now to some street interviews. Some of them just got left behind, as I seem to have been, and only got about half an hour left in the show, but if you'd like to call in, you can, 427-3772.
All right, well, it's April 15th, 2014. I'm here at the county building parking lot, about 12:20, talking with
Elijah Dixon.
And Elijah, I see you've handed me a $5,000 bill, and I don't mean a piece of currency that might actually...
Two tickets.
We're talking... This is for two tickets. So it looks like there are five items here.
Yeah, I don't know what they... She said these are taxes here. These are the taxes that, you know, I got to contact these. It's a federal tax something.
I see.
I don't know.
So
I'm confused.
Yeah, well, here this is a... I'm confused, too. I can't really tell. This is a County of Santa Cruz printout. And it's not even clear what these charges are for. So, but you just got out of jail.
I just got out of jail, back to back.
And how long were you in the slammer?
The last time I was in there for 72 days.
And this time?
72 days, 6 months, 6 months.
Another 72 days.
Yeah.
And the charges this time were?
What was it? Oh, ammunition.
You had ammunition in your van. What were you doing, carrying around that bazooka in your van?
No, it was just bullets that I took out of house. That's kind of work I did. I'm quitting. I'm leaving California.
What kind of work do you do? You're a house cleaner? Or?
No, we do demo.
Meaning?
We clean up.
I see. And how, why did the police happen to stop you? Did they have information that you cleaned up bullets?
Well, they probably, my girlfriend was, she got a problem. You know Jennifer.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
She had a problem, and she was elevating, so what they did, someone called the cops, and they came and took my tag number, and they just waited for me to come back to the van. And when I came back to the van, they said, oh, you have a warrant, probation warrant, which I didn't know. And then they went through the van and found some ammunition.
Always lock your car before you get out of it is the rule.
No, they went through it back in. I didn't know they was there.
No, I understand. Did they go through before you arrived?
No, they went through it after they came up and accosted me. They came up and said, hey, you know, they pull up with their lights.
Were you in the van when they accosted you?
I had just got back in the van.
Oh, boy. So when you get out of the van in the future, always lock the van as you get out. That's my suggestion.
Yeah.
Now, it's possible they may have a search clause that will enable them to do that. Did your previous probation have that?
Yeah, I found out I had a probation I didn't know about.
And what were you on probation for, allegedly?
What was it? It's a sentimental thing here in Santa Cruz. It's involved Officer Butler.
You were caught...
I was caught in the flats, riding through the flats one night, and she said she had to search me down because I was in an area where they do drugs. And I said, I'm not on probation or parole or nothing. I refuse that.
And then she arrested you for that?
No, she mashed the button. And I had to fight about 15 cops down there in the flats.
Wow. So then you were accused of fighting while on... but you weren't on probation.
So we have a caller, and I'm going to see if I can actually get this caller on the air. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Oh, I didn't mean to be on, and I just wanted to just tell you, man to man, I think you're having a great show. You guys keep the revolution, the renaissance, and whatever else you want to call it going.
Oh, thank you,
Bill. You're doing a great job.
All right,
we need to reflect on these things.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye. And now back to Elijah in April.
No, I went on nothing.
And this was actually after we'd spoken at the Red Church before. I guess you and I had a...
Yeah.
Actually, it must have been over a year ago because Butler got shot about a year ago.
About a year ago.
And you're an African-American guy.
Yeah.
And you're an older guy.
Yeah.
And you're a bigger guy.
And I'm a veteran, a wounded vet. I got shot. In the war.
Yeah, which war was that?
Vietnam.
Vietnam. The famous murder of the Vietnamese people war?
Yeah.
That's the one we remember.
Well, we didn't win.
Well, I'm glad we didn't. They probably should have won it. After all, those Vietnamese were assaulting L.A. I was kind of concerned about that for a long time.
And their boats, yeah.
Yeah, and their boats. Those are boat people, you know, they say. So, how was the prison? How was the jail here? Any comments? Has it gotten better or worse? Is it overcrowded? Is it fun to be in? Is it three hots in a cot?
I was up in so-called trustee unit. So
what does that mean?
I worked in the laundry. I did the laundry for them over there.
So they made you do work as well as sit behind bar.
Yeah.
Did they pay you a living wage?
No. They give you 3 meals a day.
Yeah. Are they really meals or do they just look like meals? Are they okay food?
It's okay food. I can't complain about Santa Cruz.
What's a typical meal in jail like?
Your chili mac is the big thing. You're going to get it every week, and it's macaroni with chili sauce on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they call the chili mac. You're going to get that every week.
What about your veggies? Do you get your veggies?
And we have another interruption from a caller. We'll see who this is. Hello, you're on Free Radio. Hello, you're on Free Radio. Well, try again if you'd like, but yes. We'll get back to Elijah in the parking lot of the county building in April.
They will give you veggies, but it's veggies out of a can, you know, so you can take that with a grain.
What about breakfast? What kind of breakfast do you get?
Breakfast, they change up. It's better than other county jails.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what about the safety situation in jail? How did you feel? I mean, you're blacks are in a minority in this county, and I imagine even in the county jail, though there may be a majority in many prisons or because of the disproportionate thing, Santa Cruz, there are probably a lot of black people in jail.
We have proportion in there, you know.
Yeah.
Proportion to
that. More than outside in the community.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this one black kid, I was talking to him, he got his head banged against the bed up in there.
For how did it happen?
One of the officers did it.
The black officer or a white officer?
White officer.
And do we know what the circumstances were?
It's an incident in there, and I guess they're trying to keep it from coming out.
Do you know the name of the officer, the deputy who did it?
Well, he's a shift commander.
And his name is?
What is his name? Cole.
And now, were you a witness?
Cole. I didn't witness it.
Hey,
but I witnessed his reaction to it. And he was kind of like, he didn't want to be, you know, he was kind of reserved about it. He was kind of scared that this guy, he was hoping this guy don't have enough savvy to go out and, you know, prosecute him.
So
they gave him coffee.
Oh, I see. So the deputy was scared.
Yeah.
And so first the deputy smashed his head and then decided it was better to give him a little coffee. And a little sugar in the coffee.
And that happened in front of a whole cell full of people.
Which block was it on?
Yeah.
And when did it more or less happen?
I got out on March. I got on February the 28th. That happened about a month before that. So it, maybe February the 1st or in that area there.
Late January?
Yeah.
Any impressions about jail that anything surprised you this time in jail?
Well, it's like segregated areas. You know, they got the blues, the reds. It's really segregated.
Segregated by race,
by race, and by gang. Because the north can't be with the south. Norteños. It's like that.
How many folks are in jail for gang-related stuff that you're aware of? What percentage would you say?
Lots. More fun. But most of them get designated gang, you know?
They get a gang label.
Yeah,
a gang
label. You know, if you come in like Tino, you're mostly going to get designated gang. If you come in really Pice-looking, you would get Pice designated, you know?
I'm sorry, designated what?
Pices.
Which is?
That's something like your field workers.
And what about drug offenses? Are there a lot of nonviolent drug offenses in jail, or is it mostly violent people? What's the story?
It's you know, I didn't
inquire
with the violent people there, but I'm quite sure, you know, because there's Henderson there. He's there for killing his parents, and there's other people there.
There's a few there certainly are.
Yeah, that need to be there. But the majority of them, it's the homeless people that get picked up, you know, anything. That Hoppy, he got a reputation in there for really.
Officer Hoppy, Sergeant SCBD Hoppy Man.
Yes, he got a reputation for just going around picking on people, picking on the homeless. He get away with it. They give him, probably give him promotions for doing that.
Well,
you know.
Baker, the fine Sergeant Baker, late lamented, I might add, got horizontally promoted to detective when he was accused of molesting 9 women in a press conference. So it's interesting.
The late, great Baker.
I mean the late, the grating Baker, yes.
Wow.
That was back in 1992. I was covering it then. Are you houseless now?
Yes, but I'm doing caregiving, but I'm going to have to get a job up because I'm going to have to just leave town. I can't pay for this. I can't pay for this thing.
And you're talking about the $5,000. Yeah. Are these these fines are because of...
I don't know. Where are you from?
We don't know. Superior Court.
Well, this is when I went to get my registered.
Failure to pay. It sounds like the kind of a citation, and it could have been a homeless citation. It could have been something else that's not clear. You can ask to see your whole record. You can say, give me my file. This is not giving me enough information.
There's no information at all. I don't know what this is about.
You need to know what each of these is for, and you need to see the whole record.
There's 1500 and 600 there that she said that's federal tax something.
You're evading your income tax, eh?
Yeah. I don't know what's this about.
I don't either, man. I mean, I'm just making little jokes here, but...
Yeah.
Well, if you got more information for free radio you want to pass on, I'm going to give you another one of my cards since you probably don't have it. That's not one of them. Hang on a second. We should add that you don't have anything personal against Hoppy, and apparently Hoppy doesn't have anything personal against you.
No, I don't even know that guy, but I know his reputation, and I don't approve
You've
of
never
it.
Been ticketed by him?
Never been ticketed by
him. Been invited to dinner?
Never, no. I never been invited.
No drinking buddy stuff?
I don't drink. I wouldn't drink with him, no way.
I see. So you're discriminating. if you were a drinker, you'd be discriminating.
Very.
And we've been talking with...
Elijah Dixon.
Thanks, Elijah.
Famous street interviews, which got left behind. Here's another jump forward to May. I played some of this, I believe. This is, well, I'm going to have to listen to it to be sure, but this is a continuation of an interview or a series of interviews which happened in the first U.S. out of Ukraine protest, which happened down on Pacific Avenue at Cooper Street and was going on with some regularity for a couple of weeks down there every Wednesday at 2. I don't know that it happened yesterday at 2 because I was busy with Pat here measuring the sidewalk and trying to figure out where the relevant spaces are. And John, yes, good point. And then that may actually appear on Indie Bay or in some other forum where you can actually see huge amounts of space on the public sidewalks that it's actually illegal to sit in, spare change in, busk, that is to say, play a guitar for donation in with a display device on the sidewalk, meaning an open guitar case, vend in, table in. And that really takes up, I would guess, I used to say 95% of the sidewalk. I'd say it's more now that I've continued looking at it. But I have not, you know, really done a systematic, scientific comparison of the space that's taken up by everything else. Some of it open space, which looks like free space, but actually isn't because of the hidden tripwire of Santa Cruz downtown ordinances. But anyway, here's something from the protests that happened in May. I believe the date was May 21st. So the issues with the U.S. support for the Kiev regime still continue. In fact, they're getting more intense. U.S. has sent planes over to Eastern Europe. The Ukraine and Russia broke off negotiations on an attempt to agree on the purchase of natural gas, which Ukraine is deeply in arrears for and relies heavily on Russia for. And Europe generally gets a lot of its natural gas, or a significant portion of it, I understand, from Russia through the Ukraine. So let's hear some of this discussion. Let's just listen in.
To move on up to Sam Farr's office to present this letter, which reviews the situation as it has...
This is actually not on Pacific Avenue. This is a week later. My apologies for any confusion. We actually went to the county building, and the 10 of us tried to visit Representative Sam Farr's office to denounce Obama's policy of essentially whitewashing neo-fascists in the Kiev government and their aggressive assault on people in the east of Ukraine who want to have autonomy or greater federation or even want to be allied with or a part of Russia. It's all being portrayed as some great Russian aggression scheme. And I've been persuaded that that's not what's really going on at all, but that is the sort of what's really happening is NATO is moving, as it has been doing rather relentlessly for the last 15 or 20 years, weapons and alliances against Russia into Europe, and Putin is trying to deal with this as best he can. Putin is not one of my favorite guys, by the way. None of these people are. He's just as authoritarian as other governments in many respects. But if you're talking about whether you want to buy into the bullshit that's been passing for news on Kiev and the Ukraine, you're not going to... I've been persuaded otherwise, and let's hear some what the folks who want Sam Farr to make a statement on it, and he won't, or has refused so far repeated requests. I actually haven't talked to him or talked to his office for about 2 weeks, but in the past, when I requested information, first they said, oh, yeah, sure, we'll give it to you, oh, yeah, and then sent nothing. And then finally, when we went up to visit them, they said, oh, you can come in, we'll be right here. We came up 40 minutes later, they had locked their doors and shut them. So, you know, it's your standard power does what it wants. And the danger here is you're dealing with nuclear powers who are playing chicken here, and it is not something that, you know, most Americans have been really aware of for a number of decades because it hasn't been in the headlines. There's been no Cuban Missile Crisis as there was when I was a kid over, you know, U.S. sneaking weapons into Turkey and then, you know, playing big thug to stop the Russians from bringing their, the Soviets from bringing their weapons into Cuba, instead of acknowledging that this was, you know, tit for tat. Anyway, let's hear some of the Santa Cruzans actually trying to make a difference on this issue. And I think people, the activists who are actually working on this may have become discouraged, although I'm going to give a call to Dennis Ettler, who's been doing, I did some of the organizing, and see what he says.
Helped in Ukraine and the U.S.
This actually is Dennis speaking on the tape.
Yes, role in developments there and calling on our government to cease and desist support for the regime that's been installed in Kiev and basically following the very same sort of resolutions that were just read, so I won't read them over again. Pretty much almost identical to what, you know, was just mentioned. So stop the madness, end U.S. support for Eurofascism in Ukraine. So let's march on up to Samfar's office and have him put his money on the line. Let him tell us what his position is on all of this. We want to know where he stands. No equivocating, stand against U.S. support for fascism in Ukraine.
And I think, Steve argued, I think this is summed up in four basic demands of end illegal U.S. support for the U.S.-sponsored fascist junta in Kiev, Blackwater, now renamed Academy, mercenaries out of Ukraine, U.N. stay out, end U.S. and EU sanctions against Russia, and the NATO military buildup in the region.
Yeah.
We did have a foreclosure guy, or one of them, who said...
from Dennis Ettler, that we didn't have a follow-up protest against U.S. involvement on Wednesday, and nothing is slated. So apparently the juggernaut rolls on. If anybody is planning to do anything, do give me a call at 423-HUFF, and I may just jump on board or at least pass the word around. There are some things coming up this weekend. On Saturday, there's going to be a premature Juneteenth celebration. Saturday is June 14th. Juneteenth, I believe, is June 20th. That's the day that, as I get it, the news was finally received in Texas of the end of the Civil War or the Emancipation Proclamation or everything. You know, I guess the end of the Civil War. And it became a celebratory day for folks who had previously been in slavery. That, however, is being celebrated here in Santa Cruz, as I understand it, from 2 to 5 on Saturday, the 14th, at the Loudon Nelson Center. There'll be a lot of bands. Simba Kenyatta will be there. It's free. And it's happening. You can find out more about it by going to Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org, which is where I often post my stuff. And let's see if there's anything else that should be noted. Let's see, it's Loudoun-Nelson Community Center. It may be actually inside the community center as well, but often it's in the park. Soul food, arts and crafts, kids' activities, performances reflecting the African-American culture and experience. Performances include Boostive, Earth Amplified, Miss Alameda Says Compost, Kumbwa Jazz Honor Band, Diaspora Dance Company, Rich Tycoon's Indie Artist Showcase, Mabour Fay with the Rhythm If Senegal, probably of Senegal, DJ Magnet, emceeing it is Simba Kenyatta, and Isaac Collins. Isaac is a guy who's I've praised for standing up both at Occupy and also thereafter, struggling to stand up against unjust prosecution. Basketball skills contest, 12 to 3. Parks and Rec staff will lead kids and adults in fun. Basketball skill-oriented games, Laurel Park, behind Loudoun-Nelson Community Center. And it's being co-sponsored by the Loudoun-Nelson Community Center, Inner Light Ministries, and the Arts Council of Santa Cruz. And there's a nice-looking poster here, which you can find online. Also the same day, actually, after that event, is something happening sponsored by Brent Adams, who is throwing a what he calls a sanctuary village event. His attempt to get a permit, he wasn't attempting to get a permit. He was sent an email by the permit führer, Kathy Agnon, a special event coordinator at the city manager's office, saying that she was reaching out to him since a permit will be needed for the June 14th event due to time, place, and manner, because she learned of this event, which he initially described to me as a tent mob. Kind of a flash mob. It would appear with tents on Pacific Avenue and to show people that, you know, you don't have to be afraid of tents. Don't get tense about tents. But and later it became a tent sidewalk party, which was described as having snack food and live music. Bring a tent along. We're coming together to show our solidarity with our homeless friends by hosting a happening where tents will temporarily appear on the sidewalks. We'll gather in downtown public space to socialize and talk about this issue of homelessness. This is a legal, positive loitering event. We encourage you to bring a tent to set up along the avenue. And if you're able to leave it for a homeless person, we'll bring the extra tents to the homeless service center as donations for our friends who sleep outside. It is illegal to sleep at night, and we know that literally hundreds will be sleeping out this very night. This doesn't happen without our concern for their well-being. Sanctuary Village is an initiative to establish a clean and safe place for people to sleep and keep personal belongings while they begin to heal the effects of homelessness. And it's a good idea, however token and unrealistically seeking public authority approval it may be. Brent has, you know, he's done a lot of work publicizing this idea. He does some great graphic flyers, and he's done a lot of organizing. And he was denied a permit for a sanctuary one-night campout in April. Now they're taking the initiative to attempt to discourage, and successfully discouraging him from going on the sidewalk and doing a sanctuary. I guess he's now calling it a tent village festival. He says he's going to regroup and move the event to Abbott Square, which is a place that's right off of Front and Cooper Streets. It's kind of out of the way. It's right next to Lulu Carpenter's on the square, whatever it's called. The coffee shop is at the corner of Front and Cooper Streets. And so they're going to move it there, hoping they won't have any problems there. So, again, the allowing authorities to drive you deeper and deeper away is, something that I've allowed to happen at the city council meeting. I've not been at the last three city council meetings because I intend to show up doing my audio recording as I usually do and have to be prepared to deal with it either being snatched away or facing arrest or facing other difficulties that a reporter and member of the community should not have to face. But that's what's happening in Santa Cruz. Brent, however, has a lot of people who I think he has worked with to support this. I'm surprised that he's trying to move it into a more sequestered area, though I'm not really surprised, actually. It's depressing. I'll probably be there. Huff actually voted to support the tent festival I think, Pat, you said you were going to do a Cafe Huff. Maybe we should just set up a cafe on the sidewalk where Brent left and say we're and direct people to come to it and say, you know, yes, we set up and show the very limited legal area where the tent is. And, of course, they will attempt to move you along. We can see what happens there. I don't know. I like the idea. I mean, initially, Brent talked about having tents up and down the avenue and so forth.
Every 12
feet. Yeah, well, we can't do that because the avenue doesn't have... It has a very, very limited number of legal places where you can set up. Actually, a tent is not really a display device, but it is still... You wouldn't get a camping ticket unless you intend to remain overnight. They might call it obstructing the sidewalk. I guess you could have people who have tents attached to them who would move when requested to do so. We actually did this. People tents. Haven't heard back from Brent. Huff was invited Brent to come to a meeting. He's been out of town for a while, I understand, and he also hasn't been well. His leg is seriously injured, and he's been struggling with that issue. And so, you know, hang in there, Brent. Looking like we're running out of time here. Do any of you have anything you want to say before I wrap this up? And I see head shakes all around. Didn't get as much done with the show as I'd hoped, as I said before, but I'm glad we actually had the guests we had. It's probably more interesting to folks than just hearing me go on and on, as I usually do, though I love listening to myself, of course. And we do have a lot of stuff to play. I'll be back on Sunday, presumably. A little under the weather. We'll see if I continue to feel better. Seemed to kind of on the upswing today, and so that's good. Coming up next, it's Uncle Dennis from the Cream to the